You're listening to Back to the Light with J.D. Rieger. Spray them all. Hey everybody, welcome to yet another episode of Back to the Light. I am J.D. Rieger. This week on the show, we have another in-person conversation recorded on my Memphis trip, the second of four if you're keeping track. My guest is an old friend and a client from my failed recording studio days. You know him from a ton of Memphis bands including Reginald, Noise Choir, X-Cult, and most recently, Aquarian Blood. Aquarian Blood's new album, Bending the Golden Hour, is out now on Goner Records, and you can get it at aquarianblood.bandcamp.com, goner-records.com, or any digital streaming service. Now here's my conversation with J.B. Harrell.
Check. Okay. All right, cool. I just didn't know if it was a talk into it or talk near it kind of thing.
How long have you been singing in bands? Like, most of the bands I remember you playing in were either instrumental or somebody else was singing.
I screamed in a band with Graham Burks.
Was that Pure Blood?
That was Pure Blood. That's when I think that band started when I was 16. We played our first show like a week or two after I turned 17. I never sang in a band again after that.
Why not?
Well, I didn't have a band that I was like writing material for, I was fronting or whatever until several years after that. But I played in some other bands. I played in Gringos, Adios Gringo. I played bass with them, and then moved away for a little bit, came back and started playing with some people, and that evolved into an instrumental band that I was in called Reginald. And then after that broke up, I did another instrumental band that we recorded with you guys, with you and Justin and Brendan over on, was that Cowden?
Yeah, Cowden, and then eventually, didn't you guys come over to Highland a couple of times after that?
Might have done that too, yeah. I remember that first EP we did with Noise Choir in 2005, we did in the attic on Cowden. And I'll never forget that spot when you guys were recording there, because it was a great room too. It was fun. It was like, you guys were fun to work with, but I remember that there was an LP that was thumbtacked to the wall, sans cover, so you couldn't see. We're just looking at it one day when we're mixing, because you remember that mixing board was kind of over in that corner where all the mixing stuff was. And it was Clark Hutchinson. Do you remember that record? And it has that song, Free to Be Stoned.
I don't remember that being up on the wall.
And I was looking at it, and I had never heard of it. And I was like, what is this?
I don't.
And we were all talking about it, and y'all were like, it's a record that's, I don't remember if it had been listened to, or y'all had listened to it at some point, but it was kind of like an offhanded thing. And y'all let me borrow it, if you remember that. And we brought it back and stuck it back to the wall, but this is what it was. And I was blown away. I don't want to be good, but I don't care if I'm bad. I don't want to feel happy. Totally relatable.
But I don't care. I just wanna be.
Oh, here it goes.
I just wanna be. I just wanna be. Stop.
I don't remember this at all.
And then the groove comes in. It's badass. Hold on. Here he goes. It's that shit where you went and you go, ooh.
Because when I'm stoned, everything I do seems to turn out right.
See?
Shoot.
This, and y'all have, and I was like, dude, this
I have
is
no memory of the record on the wall or loaning it to you or anything like that.
1970, Clark Hutchinson. It's called Retribution. We brought it back. We even had it like put it in like a little paper sleeve and a blank cover, I think, when we brought it back. And it just went right back up on the wall. And I don't know if you, Justin, or Brendan ended up with it, but I was like, whoever ended up with it, I wish I was them. That record's awesome.
I wish
that
I remembered
so
that.
I got so passionate about
being free to be stoned.
That was great that you just had that so quickly at your disposal.
Well, I got to thinking the other day when I knew that you were coming back in town and we were going to talk, and I was like, just thinking about that time, that experience of recording with you, and you guys basically not only engineering but producing those sessions, because we were just kind of in there, you know, throwing shit at the wall. We didn't really know what we were doing as far as what your setup was. You know, I'd recorded in studios before. We recorded at, Reginald recorded at Easley with Stuart Sykes twice. I think we did put out two like CDRs back in like 2000 or 1999 or something like that. But anyways, sorry, man, I'm just sitting here talking. So
no, that's what the show is.
Oh, okay.
Didn't Reginald also end up playing a gig at the Penal Farm? I remember you telling me a story about that.
Glad you asked me. Yeah, I have a cassette of that. There was a program that they had at the Penal Farm in the 90s where bands or entertainers, I guess, because it wasn't always just bands. They might even have like jugglers and stuff. I don't know what all they had, you know, like some kind of just performance stuff that they had for people who were serving time who had good behavior and had done certain things to warrant them getting extra privileges. And you could basically apply for this program if you wanted to go give a performance for the inmates. And we got in touch with the woman who was in charge of that, and she said that the last person that they had was an Elvis impersonator, and that the inmates didn't react real well to it, that they weren't, you know, they're not rude, they can't be. They have very strict rules that they have to adhere to while they're watching the band or the performer or whatever's going on, but that she could tell that wasn't really their thing. So she was asking me, what is it that you guys do? We had to send in a CD. They had to kind of vet the whole thing and make sure that we were okay to, or that they thought it would be appropriate. And since it was instrumental music, that was however you would describe that music, I don't know, just instrumental rock music, surfy, whatever weird shit we were doing, but and I guess she thought it was agreeable enough that it wouldn't cause
start a riot.
Yeah, it wouldn't start a riot, it wouldn't cause a commotion, but also they wouldn't just be put to sleep or be like, fuck, I just want to go back to my area and fucking chill. So we sent her the CD and she said it was fine, we could come out. But then we had to do background checks, and we had one person that was in the band at the time that was playing with us had a charge pending, a small possession charge, so they weren't allowed to go. But yeah, we got there and we checked in at the front, and they led us to this big gate, and we drove our van back to this gymnasium that's at on a part of the Penal Farm that you can't see from like any of the like Agri Center, or not Agri Center, but Shelby Farms or any of that. It's like kind of back in there. There's a gymnasium, just kind of like a high school gymnasium removed from the building. And we had to go through a metal detector and do all that, and they kind of looked through our stuff or whatever. And so we went in and set up in this gymnasium. But see, when we got there, it rather than play at one end of the gymnasium, like where there was a basketball court, they had us like along one side of it. So we're playing like kind of not the length of the gymnasium, but kind of like the across it.
Right.
But they had three groups of chairs, and there was about 300 people that were in there, and they already had them in there. And I thought it would be a thing where we got there and like set up and then they would come in, but they were already there. So they were just kind of watching us set up, and like, you know, we didn't have a PA, we didn't have vocals or anything.
Strange.
But we did have a PA because we had a mic, so we could just talk and tell them who we were, we could communicate, but it wasn't a fancy like nightclub setup. It was literally like two speakers and a microphone. And we got set up and we started playing, and they seemed like they dug it. Like they started kind of reacting, and the woman told us that you like please that we not use any profanity or anything, and don't do anything that would like maybe rile them up or instigate them, but also that they were not allowed to stand up, they had to sit down the whole time. And so I was like, all right. We started playing. By the time we were done with the first song, I've got this on, like I said, I gotta find it. By the time we got done with the first song, we did kind of like, you know, some kind of driving like rhythmic thing, and we're up there like, you know, doing our thing, and they all stood up and were like hollering, you know, they were digging it, and they were, but and at no point, and the thing is, they had the jail lined with like sheriff's deputies, and some of them had shotguns or whatever. I was like, this is fucking crazy. And at one point I had to go to the bathroom. Well, I'll get to that, but so we're doing, and they're standing up, and the woman's kind of like, ah, you know, she's there, and she's like, this is not supposed to be, they're not supposed to be standing up, they're not supposed to be doing this, but they let them do it as long as they weren't, you know, they weren't rushing the stage or anything, but as we kept playing and then and jamming, this dude asked if he could get up there and sing a song.
Like an inmate.
He was near the front row, in the second row, probably in the middle section. Like I said, there was three sections, about 100 people each, and she was like, this is a, she was like, they didn't want him to, but finally they let him for whatever reason. He was like, I want to get up there, and he came up there, and because we had the mic to address the crowd, he got up there, and he wanted his friend to play guitar. So I was like happy to give this dude, other dude, my guitar, and they played Sam Cooke, you know, that song, Chain Gang, or that's the sound of men working on the chain gang, drawing a blank on the title. I was like, oh, that's
Chain Gang.
Yeah, Chain Gang. And so they play, he played that song, and it was like, he was singing it, and dude, that's when the inmates really like started fucking going nuts. And so while he was doing it, I went over and sat, they kind of made room in the front, somebody went around to the second row and got his seat, and I went and sat with the dudes in the thing so I could watch them perform. Well, then this guy's just playing my guitar, and our drummer's kind of playing along with him, and we had a guy playing synth with us at the time, and they kind of broke into this, like, you know, sub bass groove, like real straightforward, what you, a hip hop type of beat. And these two young dudes, man, they look like they might have been 18, 19, early 20s at the very oldest. They got up there and they had a whole routine about one man army. I don't need no set to ride for me. One man army. Don't need no set to die for me. And then they would switch off going into verses and come back to this chorus. And like our synth player and drummer kind of like worked into this groove with them. And by that point, it was just fucking nuts. But it was while that was going, I was like, I gotta piss. And I walk over to this bathroom, and so all the like sheriff's deputies are watching what's going on the stage and in the crowd and all this shit, like really paying attention, don't notice me. And right as I go in the bathroom, I take a piss, this guard comes in there, he's like, you are not supposed to use this bathroom, get out of here. I didn't realize I was using like the common bathroom for the inmates. So I was like, oh, I didn't even think of that. And they made me go back out through this little fence thing to use the bathroom. But so that was kind of crazy. But it was fascinating. And so by the time, and so I came back and they had done their little repertoire. None of that was supposed to happen or be allowed to happen, but I think that it says a lot about the woman who booked us and the people who had these rules in place for them, that they let them do this, because in no way was it dangerous or destructive. If anything, I think it was very constructive to let them not just express themselves, but appreciate each other expressing themselves in this way that you don't see when you're just in prison with these people all day, every day.
Yeah. I was wondering if maybe your takeaway from that was maybe some sort of good feelings about giving a forum to these guys who maybe haven't had access to music in a long time.
I had a good feeling because they gave me a forum to experience, you know, being, you know, playing music and being in bands, there's nights where you play shows and people are responsive, and you know, whether or not you know the crowd, it goes great. And there's other nights where it just nosedives, and there's some nights where it's just kind of in the middle somewhere, you know. It runs the gamut on the spectrum, but to play to a group of people who aren't there just because it's a social lubricant or to have drinks or even maybe just enjoy music, they're there because it's something other than the mundane, what I would in my mind imagine be misery of being incarcerated, and to see this, but then also be able to participate in it. I had a good feeling that they gave me a venue to experience that too. So I hope that it was a two-way street. I feel like it was, but, and then I know when they left, there was this weird window behind where the stage was, and they're all going down the hallway, like banging on the window, and like, you know, they were all stoked. But I was like, I asked him too. I was like, I noticed after the fact, the woman was like, this was really fun. You know, she may be like, wow, that kind of like went somewhere that we didn't expect it, but it's okay. they don't have the program anymore. I followed up and tried to see if we could go back and do something like that. But I asked her, I was like, how did they get, I was like, I didn't know that y'all let female inmates into the thing. And she's like, there was no female inmates in here. And I was like, I saw three women, like, you know, and they were done up too. I've never been in served time in the penal farm or anywhere other than like just being downtown for very briefly for a few hours. But when they were done up, you know, made up, hair, nails, all this stuff. And she was like, it was all males. And I was like, oh, I see what's going on. But it's just interesting.
And you said you still have the tape of it?
I do. I have a cassette of it.
You ever thought about putting it out?
Man, every time I think about it, something else comes in my mind, and I just don't. The first thing I need to do is have it digitized. You know, I at least need to have it preserved because it's sitting on a Maxell 90-minute cassette in like an old American Tourist or like one of those little things that you put cosmetics in that's about this big.
Yeah.
And it's
yeah.
just full of old cassette tapes of like demos and stuff I'd worked on. So it's just sitting in there. I don't even think it's in a case. Pretty bad about taking care of stuff like that. But I should pull it out and digitize it.
Well, I can, you know, after the show, we can talk about that.
We'll talk. Okay, yeah, that would be great.
So... All right, well, tell me how you get from Reginald to Noise Choir, because it's kind of a continuation. I mean, you have similar members, or at least one, Jimmy, right?
Jimmy was the same, and then Alex moved to Portland. He was our bass player, and so I guess at that point, because it didn't come directly after. Noise Choir didn't start. There was a three- or four-year gap between. No, I did sing for a band, because I was in a band with Andrew McCullough and... a bunch of different people. Quinn Powers was in it for a while, Brandon Reisig, and it had a bunch of different names. At one point, I think it was Alphabetical Order, and I did sing for that band, and that was 2001, 2002, probably.
Hmm.
Or no, 2003. Whenever there was a group of kids that lived in a warehouse down on Madison, kind of in that Marshall Arts District.
Yeah, yeah.
And like when Black Lips came here the first time, they played there. We played at at the warehouse where all these kids, like Patrick Glass lived there. Zach Pressler lived there. Quinn lived there. I'm trying to remember who all lived at this warehouse, but it was a warehouse. And so kind of, there's like a little scene down there. And I remember playing there. I don't remember many places we played, maybe the deli. That band wasn't real active. We didn't ever release any recordings or anything. It was just like something we were doing, and I kind of got burned out on that. And then started doing Noise Choir with Jimmy again, but had Chris Brown playing bass with us. And Patrick was in that band too.
Yeah, yeah. No, I remember you guys were a great band. I always loved the bass player, especially.
Chris Brown.
Yeah, he had some like, he was the one, that thing where you say, it's the notes he's not playing. That's really true of him.
He's a great bass player. He's a great all-around musician.
He knows when to lay back.
Exactly. He knows when not to play.
Yeah.
It's important. Yeah, he's a great musician. His father is a musician, too. His father is like a diehard Beatles fanatic and has all the guitars and all that stuff. But he's also, or he was for years, the music director at Independent Presbyterian. So he comes from a very musical background, both secular and, you know, his dad being at a Presbyterian church. So Chris is, yeah, he's a very talented musician. All those guys are. I feel lucky for playing with all of them.
So what happened with that band? I know we made the EP, which was awesome. That was my favorite thing we did together. And then you guys also came back and did a full length, right?
Yeah, we did another. Yeah, we did another full length thing. And this is in the era where, you know, pre-Bandcamp, pre-like pay somebody to put this stuff on your platform, and nobody was interested in releasing it other than us. So we were just making CDRs with like you know, Xerox covers, and that's what we did, and just played around town. Yeah, that's what I mean. There's like really nothing going on with it at all.
Well,
but it was fun.
I mean, it was a great band, and especially that EP is still maybe one of the greatest sounding things that we ever did. I don't know if it was the amount of time we all put into it or whatever, but it just like. Something about it, like when I hear Muscular Pony.
That first song, I still appreciate.
I go straight back to that place.
Yeah, yeah, that song still, that one kind of stands up. We did a reunion thing December before this past one. So like less than a year and a half, about a year and a half ago, it was a couple of the dudes from Fugazi. It was the rhythm section, the bass player and drummer, and we played at Minglewood with them as Noise Choir. And that was pretty, that was fun, that was interesting. Because after Jimmy moved while we were doing Noise Choir, and Lee Sammons came in and he played drums too. So when we did those shows, I think that they both played. And
yeah, I remember playing one show with Lee on drums. I think like, what was that metal bar on Highland?
Oh.
We played a show together there.
The place that had dog shit on the floor.
Yeah.
The Rally Point.
Yes.
Yeah, dude, they had a cat. Dude, I'm tall, but they had a fucking couch for you to sit on while you're watching the bands. But if you need to sit down while you're watching the band, but
That happens at some point in the evening. But
sure.
They didn't have legs on it, so they put it on kegs. And a keg's taller than the legs of a couch. And so by the time you got like yourself up over the height of the kegs and then the like padding on the couch, you had to like jump to get on. I was like, this is weird. And there was dog shit on the floor. That was a rally point.
I didn't remember that.
Yeah.
So at what point do you start doing X-Cult?
When I finally quit playing in bands for a second, I'd gone back to school as like an adult dad, like 34. I went back to college and sort of just started from scratch. And I've been playing, there's another band I was playing with called Hedge Creep, Bill Curry.
Oh, I'd forgotten you were, you had joined Hedge Creep for a while.
Yeah, you know.
And Brandon was in with you guys for a while too, wasn't he? Or did you replace?
Brandon took over when I left.
Okay.
And then Brandon left and I played, and then I got in it again for a while. And so right about when, in 2010, September 2010 is the last time that Noise Choir played a show. That was our last show up until this like reunion thing I was just talking about. But it was like a year ago. But we had quit playing, and I had told Hedge Creep, I was like, I'm going to chill now because school was getting pretty intense, and that's something that I wanted to focus on. And so instead of being in like two or three bands, I was in no bands for the first time in like, I don't know how long, a long time.
How did that feel?
It wasn't bothering me, I guess, at the time, because I always play guitar. I just like to play guitar. That's just a thing. I don't really, it's not like I have to be writing or doing something for a band. You know, I just like to play. So I was content just playing guitar and like going to school and working, which being, having two kids and being married and working full time and going to school full time, that'll like, that eats up time. So,
I can imagine.
It's kind of hard to like, to focus on, like having a band. And by that point, kind of like going all the way back to after I was in the Gringos, after that experience, I was like, if I'm going to be in a band, like only one band, at least one, I want to be like writing stuff and sort of, you know, figuring out who I want to play with to do it. And I wasn't really looking to just, I'm not really that type of guitar player. I'm not like good enough to just be like, hey, I can like come sit in for a gig with your band and pick up the changes. Like, I don't know that. I have to like practice a million times or whatever to remember the stuff. So it felt good to not be playing, but I think that not focusing on so many different things at one time was a good thing. And so when X-Cult came along, I had talked to Chris, the singer. I didn't know him at all. Had like met him socially a couple times, and I knew Michael Peary a little bit. And it was just the three of us were gonna get together and jam. And I had no idea what to expect, and they were way younger than I was. And I knew Michael from Egyptian Eyes, and I knew him from Magic Kids. And so when they came over, I had no idea what I thought they were going to want to do. Chris had been in this band Vile Nation, and I thought they were going to want to do like full on just like a hardcore band or whatever. And I was like, so I, you know, I have this distortion pit on this guitar. And then they come over and they start showing me. Michael had written like, I think the first song, what ended up being the first song that we used for on our first single. And I was like, okay, this is a different type of approach than just like a full-on hardcore band, which is what I thought it would be. But we had drums and guitar, and Chris was like singing. We're like, this sounds pretty thin, so we're like, we need another guitar player, and they called Alec. And so Alec came over. He was booking a place called The Dairy. Do you remember when The Dairy was having shows?
Oh, yeah. I played there once or twice.
Yeah, so he was living there and booking that that place. Alec came here from Richmond, Virginia to go to MCA. And then we had a bass player, Alex Burden, and she practiced and played the first show in February of 2011. And then she didn't want to do it anymore, whatever happened. And then Natalie started playing bass with us, Natalie Hoffman. So that's how that started. But it was fun. It was fun. I felt like it was fun to take time away from being in bands at all. And then when I did get back into it, doing it with people that I had not already been playing with, because I feel like sometimes when I keep going back to the same people, as much as I love the familiarity of playing with them, I fall back into familiar modes of in my approach or in the playing or in what I'm trying to do. So
that makes me think of the first folks I played with when I moved to Chicago. I had been pretty burned out, you know, from Memphis for a while. I didn't play for like a year. And then these guys were just completely different, a lot younger, and, you know, completely different mindset than like your average you know, Memphis dude or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was invigorating.
Yeah, it feels good. And you're like, this is just a whole different people.
Well, these people aren't jaded and don't hate music.
Right, right. Well, and that, and there's not already, like, you haven't already explored what you can do with these people. And so it's a new thing, you know. It's, I mean, you know, you make new friends and you keep the old, but it is fun to explore, like, where you can go with people that you haven't already, you know, traversed some of these paths with them musically. And it's like, it's exciting, you know. To me, it is.
Obviously, when you guys get together, you would have no idea that, like, Goner would get behind it and, like, no. Ty Segall would get into it and all that kind of stuff.
No. In fact, I thought it was safe as far as me trying to preserve having a lot of free time for, not free time, but just the time needed for school work and parenting and being married and all that. So I was like, this is going to be something that's not going to eat into my time, like if I was playing with the same cats and we started a new instrumental band or whatever we were gonna do, you know what I mean? I was like, this will just be something I can do. It if I like it, I can stick with it. If I don't, I don't have to overextend myself or overcommit myself to this. But we practiced for the first time in early December of 2010 and played our first show in February of 2011, like 2 months later, and made a demo by April. And they immediately, Goner said that they would do a single that came out in September. So it was like, well, that will just, I'll just keep doing this. But it's, they were pretty intense about it after they got to that point, though. When I say intense, it was like, let's have band practice twice a week. And it was several hours, like really try to make this evolve quickly. And then we went to South by Southwest that next March. And that's when Ty saw it. And he was like, well, he kind of knew Chris. I think he had played in Memphis before and stayed at Chris's house or something like that, or they'd hung out in New Orleans one time, like, so he kind of knew Chris, but he didn't know the band. And we played just a Goner showcase at Beerland, and he was there playing with Michael Cronin and offered to produce the first record. So we went to San Francisco and made that first record. So it was like a pretty fast as far as like going from having the first practice to having the first single to working on the first LP. And then you know, we did a tour with him that started in like Tucson and went through Texas and came through Memphis and went all the way up through New York and stuff and went to Canada and then back down through like Chicago and all that and then through Nebraska to Colorado. And it was like a full month like of being on the road.
Yeah.
And after that, I was just like, dude, man, when I started playing music with Graham back in, when I was a teenager, there was only three things that I needed to achieve. Only three things that mattered because of the music we were playing, like being in a hardcore band at the time and even any other music that I was marginally interested in, there was no possibility of making like any kind of real career. You know, even people who were in the bands that were at the top of that scene, they weren't fucking rock stars. That wasn't a thing. That was like sort of disgusting to me, as a matter of fact. It's not about the money or any of that. It's about hanging out with your friends and making this thing and doing something that gives you a reason beyond just fucking going to work or school or whatever, you know.
Oh man, amen.
Yeah. And so my whole thing was, if I can get a vinyl release, if I can just get a record out, which I played on the first two Gringo singles, so that happened, that was like 95, so I got that one knocked out. But then I wanted to tour the US and I wanted to tour Europe. Now if I could ever go to Japan or Australia, I haven't been those places, it could still happen, but I just wanted to be able to do those things. And so I could see that X-Cult was like pretty quickly that would be the means to do those things, and I would have all three of those main three goals knocked out. Where, and so that was the thing, if I can do this, like my goals were so, I'm not going to say it's simple, because it's not easy to start a band and get somebody to pay for you to fly to Europe. It's not easy to get somebody to put your music on vinyl. It's not.
Yeah.
And I don't take that stuff for granted, and I love the people who have like collaborated with me or have been supportive and done it. But having real, I think, fairly obtainable goals has been something that's kind of kept me going at times. Because you were asking, like, what was it like not being in a band? I was like, it was kind of chill. It was, you know, wasn't really sweating it too bad. But there was still shit I wanted to do, you know. So some of that stuff wasn't off the table. It was never a thing where, like, you know, you've known people like this who are like, well, you know, I don't know how old you are. I'm 47.
42.
Okay, so we're in the same basic range. And how many people do you know that were like just like shot out from high school, early 20s, like a rocket in their music thing, but for whatever reason it doesn't do what they wanted to do, or they have family or career, any of these things. And so now they just say, well, I just don't have time. And I totally understand that. It made me understand that, because I used to be like, oh, that's sort of a cop out. Like, why would you quit? And it's like, well, to each his own, you know. Yeah. But I understand now why people were like, you know, it just gets to be a thing. It's an investment of time and energy and emotion. There's a lot of things, but it's also a release from those things. So it's always interesting to me that when people are like, you know, just not into it anymore. I can't imagine that.
You know, it's funny. Like, I remember us having a conversation probably 10, 15 years ago where you were talking about, like, how, like, you had realized that at this, the age you were, like, you were never going to make it.
Yeah.
And, like,
I still haven't. And that's, and I'm fine with it, because it makes me feel like I can do whatever the fuck I want to do. You know, I don't have to stay in a box, I guess.
Well, but don't you think you kind of did a little bit?
Dude, look, I just came from work painting apartments, man. I'm covered in paint. I achieved my goals. That is what I did. In that sense, yes, I did. I made it. That kind of just sounds like I just said I didn't do what I just said I did. But no, you're right. I did achieve my goals. I don't know what making it is. Here we go. This is a good... Making it is whatever you make it out to be in your head. And so in that sense, yeah, I made it. I got... There's records out there on vinyl. And that was so important to me, because I grew up in the age when CDs, like, you know, you did too, when CDs were like, there was a point where if you had given me a choice between a CD and a record, I would have picked the CD.
Yeah.
After our having already too. Collected there's no, records. Yeah.
There's no record player in a car.
Right. Exactly. So. Exactly. There was a thing about vinyl, and there was a thing about touring the US, and then a thing about going to Europe. And it's, yeah. So in that sense, I achieved my goals, I guess. And that's why it feels good now. And it probably directly feeds into why now I'm comfortable at this point in, like, music for me and at my age, where I'm just like, I'm just going to sit here and play this nylon string guitar and sit at home and make music with Laurel and me and just do that. The one thing I can say is, like, I was telling you about, I have this, like, arm weird, I don't know what this affliction thing is. It's brachial neuritis, but... So I can't really play it. It's very awkward to stand up and play guitar. I played that one show like that. And it's like, dude, about 10 minutes in, it's like, I don't know how I'm going to get through the rest of it. It's like a 25-minute set. It's very hard to play electric guitar and stand up. It's very hard to play guitar, like, standing up, period, without holding it the way I do with the nylon string now that I was showing you earlier. But the other thing that I had started to think about is that I don't want to stop playing music. Like, I have no intention of stopping. It's not even a question of that. It just, you know, I come home from work, and it's like, you can only stare at your phone so long, or stream so many episodes of a TV show, or listen to my record collection, or ride my bike, or do whatever. My kids are grown and, you know, pretty much out of the house by now. My daughter's she's 19, but she's about to move out. So got a lot more time and want to keep going, want to keep making music, and want to travel with it. And if we can keep making records. But I also know that, and there's nothing wrong with people that do this, I don't want to be that cat that's like rocking the fuck out with an electric guitar when I'm like 50 something. I just don't. It's not interesting to me. I'm not saying it won't happen, that at some point in my 50s, I won't rock out with an electric guitar, but I don't want... That's not what I want to do, because, I mean, it's such a weird thing now. It's like, we talk about it sometimes at home. It's like, I don't admit, like, I would like to fucking go nuts when I'm rocking, you know, like, fucking get into it. That's what the people I grew up seeing, even when I was in those instrumental bands, like, that we were talking about earlier, it's like...
No, you would get into it on stage.
The presentation is the same thing as, like, the very first punk bands I saw when I was a kid. It's like, these people were fucking going nuts. It was almost like, holy shit, like, and so that energy stays the same, whether it's this little, like, instrumental thing that we're doing or whatever. But as time goes on and everything, and I definitely got to exercise a lot of that with, like, Hedge Creep or Adios Gringo or X-Cole, like, can rock out and do this stuff. But as I get older, it's like, yeah, I want to have something that I can do, like, you know, that I don't have to worry if I twist my ankle, you know, I don't have health insurance for, like, bang my head and, like, you know, get a fucking crick in my neck. Am I gonna be able to go paint apartments to survive because I was, like, rocking too hard at Murphy's last Friday? You know, I just don't. No, dude, I want to just sit here with the fucking little guitar and just be like, sing about my weed guy spraying the bills off with Lysol or whatever, you know, and just do that.
Well, hell, apparently that'll get you a review in the New Yorker.
I don't even know how that you saw that.
I was looking up the reviews. That's the first thing that comes up, is that New Yorker thing.
Weird. It's so weird. Yeah. I don't know. That I don't.
Time out. Before we get back to JB Harrell, I want to let you know about a few things. I have a show this week as I record this, Thursday, July 22nd to be exact, at the Savemore Lounge on Lincoln in Chicago. This Friday, the Loose Opinions single, Yesterday Never Arrives, drops at looseopinions.com or backtothelight.net. In fact, you can stay tuned at backtothelight.net for more info about three big Back to the Light shows coming up in Memphis in August. As always, to support me and the show, visit patreon.com/JDRieger. And now, the ad. Just heard Bolted and Embossed from the new Aquarian Blood album Bending the Golden Hour. Let's get back to me and JB.
When did you and Laurel get together?
We met, I was living with Bill Curry in 2004, and she was working out at Glacier National Park, and she was moving back to Memphis, and our third roommate was moving out, and she was coming back from Glacier and taking back her job at the deli that she used to have. She was reemployed there and needed a place to live, so she was my roommate. And we just, you know, being roommates, we just started hanging out and talking and listening to music and whatever, and then we got together, and that was 2004, and then we got married in 2009. And we talked about, like, playing music. You know, I would sit around and strum my guitar, and something I'd noticed about her, I was like, if she was just singing, like, in the car or in the kitchen with music, I was like, damn, she can actually sing, but she's very shy about it. And she didn't play an instrument at that point. And, yeah, we got married in 2009, and then I think it was 2008, I guess it was the year before that, we were outside. So we were playing music together by the time we got married. We were sitting outside. I don't know why I touched that. I hope I didn't fuck anything up.
No, you did fine.
I'm like touching shit. That's why I don't go in a studio. That's why I record everything at home. Just like touching shit like a child. But we were outside one night, man, and she was hula hooping. She's real good at hula hooping. She can, like, do that shit with her neck and, like, make work it down to her ankle and shit and go out on her arm. And I was like, man,
I can't even do it regular.
I can't either, man. I sit there and try it, and I just feel like look like a jackass. But I was like, dude, you're really good at that. I was like, and she's a good dancer, too. I was like, man, that's, like, a really rhythmic thing. I was like, you know, I would imagine that having that kind of rhythm, you can coordinate your body. You could, at all, you know, all limbs at once, you could play drums. And we have, you know, we had a band room in the house, like we're sitting in now with everything set up, the PA and the drums and everything. So I went in there and she was like, all right. And she's sitting at the drum kit and like, okay, what do I do? You know, what are you going to tell somebody to do? See, I have a little thing over there. I hear this. Have you ever showed somebody how to play drums? Because I suck at drums.
I have taught someone how to play drums.
This is the thing. I was like, if you were going to show somebody how to play drums, what would you show them? And I was like, fuck, I don't know. And I just did this. You know? And that, dude, she sat down and just did it. And I was like, okay, well then let me pick up my guitar. And so I'm going, jun, 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 you know? And then like, an hour later, I'm like writing this song or whatever. I was like, okay, well, fuck. I was like, let's keep doing this. And I was already in X Cult, so I was like, oh, cool. Now I'll get myself in a second band and like have more shit that I got to keep up with. But so we started that band, Moving Finger, and Patrick Glass was in that band too. And then Natalie Hoffman was in it for a while too. But we started doing that in at the end of 2008. Now, what the fuck am I talking about? We got married in 2012. Everything I just said is wrong because X-Cult didn't start till 2010. Okay, so we got married in 2012. So at the end of 2011 is when she started playing drums. And we had that band Moving Finger, and we did one single on Goner that came out in... God, my years are so freaking weird. I don't even remember. 2013 or 2013 the single came out.
I'm bad at this timeline stuff too.
Yeah, I was just saying, like, yeah, so 2013 we had a single that came out, and then we quit doing that band, and she was in Knots and played on the first two singles. And so at that point we had done Moving Finger and we quit, and she quit doing Knots so we could focus on this home recording thing, and that's what Aquarian Blood was. So that's how, I don't even know if that's what we were talking about, but that's how we got there.
Is there a different dynamic as a bandmate with your partner? Like, I've played in bands with married couples before, and it's always kind of an interesting thing to observe. Do you, there ever any issues, or is it easy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's easy. It's easy because, yeah, it's very easy because just like we're sitting here talking right now is like what she and I would be doing at home, but we're surrounded by guitars and drums. And so if we weren't here for the purpose of doing this podcast, but we're just sitting here cracking beers and like visiting, it's likely at some point that some of this shit would get turned on and we would fuck around, right? So yeah. It's the same thing. We're at home in the evening and you're just chilling, or anytime. I always say that. I always think of it as just like, because we have day jobs, you know, and you get home in the evening and it's like you can unwind. And like I said, we're not really TV people, and that really, TV doesn't even have anything to do with it. We just like to sit there and play, you know, and just the same reason anybody does anything. And it's our process is so familiar at this point and is so far into itself, like what it does, that it just is very automatic now. And it's very productive and efficient. Yeah.
Is the progress of the band sound, is that mostly because of the arm injury?
No. Well, if you go back, when we started Aquarian Blood, we started recording at home for fun. And some of those earliest songs are, there's one called Bigfoot. There's another one that's called Knife of Mobile Bay that's on the second tape. But, they were completely acoustic based songs. And this is something that going back, probably even around that time, I was telling you, I had this band in the early 2000s with Andrew McCullough and Quinn, and those people were varying lineups. And it's kind of probably when I started paying more attention to actual songwriting. Because with the instrumental band, it's just a lot of riffs. You know, I'm writing riffs, man, or grooves or whatever. But when you have to make room for vocals, it's a much different thing, you know? And so it's probably when I first explored like songwriting in the context of what we're doing now versus making something that's just sonically doing this thing that you're kind of adding vocals to. as far as how you put a song together and what the components are. I started really focusing on that probably then, but didn't really revisit it until we had this earliest version of Aquarian Blood, where we were making something that was never going to get released, and it was never going to be a band. It was just the two of us at home making these recordings. And a friend of mine named Arjun, he has a sitar group called Nonviolence.
Oh yeah, I remember them.
Yeah, and he's got I played on a couple records with him and Ben Bauermeister and some other people.
Wasn't Andrew in that too?
Andrew wasn't on it, but he recorded some of it.
Oh, that's right. Maybe he was just a big proponent.
Andrew was a big proponent of Nonviolence. And Arjun had a tape label with a friend in Brooklyn. It was called Zap Cassettes. And he asked what we were working on. And I was like, at the time, Laurel was doing Knots and I was doing X-Cult. And I think we were done with Moving Finger. And I was like, well, we have these recordings we're doing. We're calling it Aquarian Blood. And he was like, can I hear it? And I gave him the 15 songs that were on the first tape, and he was like, well, we want to put this out on our tape. And I was like, cool, because we don't have a band or anything, you know. I was playing drums, she was playing drums, we were just taking turns playing different instruments on this stuff. And so some of it was very little of it was acoustic, some of it was, most of it was like just kind of full-blown, like what the first Aquarian Blood record is, kind of bombastic home recorded stuff. But he put it out, and I guess the other guy that, because Arjun was living in Atlanta, but his partner was in Brooklyn, and Brian Turner, I think, at WFMU got it and played it one day. I didn't know it had been on WFMU. I didn't know anything about this. And I think Zach is the one who told me he had heard it on, Zach Ives told me he had heard it on Brian Turner's show, and he liked it. And he was like, can we hear, you know, can I hear more stuff that you guys have? So we gave them some stuff we were working on. But in the meantime, we had given Arjun another set of tunes because he was happy with the way that first tape went, and we did a second one, I think, that same year. So we had the first two tapes, like 15 songs each. Because once we started doing this at home, we just started cranking out. Like, any idea we had, we just turn into a song. You know, good, bad, or indifferent, just make the song. Like, make it, get done with it. That's very much part of our process, too. I don't really, like, fuck around and go back and be like, could have done that better, you know? Or like, this is too loud. I don't do that shit at all. I'm just like, it's done. Just go to the next thing, and if we need to, we'll revisit it, but usually, like, never do that. And so Aquarian Blood did a single for Goner, was for Record Store Day in 2015. And then we did that first LP. I wasn't very happy with that first LP at all, because that was the first time that I felt like we were making a record. This all feeds into how I got to where what we're doing now, because we were making, and they said, hey, we'll do a full-length record, but I didn't already have it written and recorded. So I was like, it was more deliberate. I feel like conscious, like thinking like, okay, we got to do these songs, we got to sequence them. And some of it was recorded at home, some of it was done with McCalla. So it was like, shit. And in fact, we had recorded the whole like core of the band tracks and then lost them because I got a digital machine too close to a sub one night. And I think the magnet or something wiped the machine. And Andrew was like, fuck, dude, we had to go back in.
Oh,
the
drag,
following
man.
Week, yeah, I was buzzed and I got the thing too close to the sub and I was cranking the bass and it erased the machine. So we had to like recut. It was just like one thing after another. And then, so the record finally came out. And it's not that I'm not happy with the record, I just feel like we could have done it better, but whatever. People say that shit all the time. They're like, oh, I could have done it. And we didn't get to tour a lot on it. Like, we made it up the East Coast. We went to New York and played and went through the Midwest and did like one tour on it. And we got back. Bill broke his arm, Bill Curry. He was our drummer. He broke his arm. And so we were like, well, shit, we're going to be down for a while. You know, we can't do anything. And we had some of those acoustic songs from the earlier recordings I was telling you. That was the other thing. We put that whole band together after these tapes and everything had come out because people were like, oh, play some shows. And we're like, no, who do we know that's a drummer? Bill. Who do we know that plays bass? Drewby. And then we got Coltrane Duckworth to play guitar, who I didn't know very well. He was like 17 at the time, but I had seen him play what was that skate rock band he's in?
I don't know. I know his dad more than I know
Jim. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was my daughter's English teacher. Jim's awesome. But so Coltrane started playing. So we put together a band because we already had like a couple tapes out and shit. So that whole thing was weird. And then like, but it was fun. It was cool. And I was glad that they did it. But we just didn't get to tour like we wanted to. And then Bill broke his arm. It's like, what are we going to do? And so we had these acoustic songs. And Zach was like, do you guys want to play a show of this stuff? I think we did it at DKDC, and we did a stripped down version of the band. It was more of the acoustic based stuff with Keith Cooper playing like a synth and Coltrane playing guitar. And so we just have started going that direction. And then when Bill came back, we played some shows, but it wasn't long after that where I had this arm injury, and it made it like very hard to play guitar, like I was saying, standing up, or electric guitar and shit. And so I just spent more and more time kind of figuring out, kind of relearning to play with my guitar in a completely different position, because now I'm like, it's all finger picking that I do. I don't strum, and it's finger picking that's I'm having to do with the guitar held vertically instead of horizontally. And it kind of made it different to do it. So there's a little bit of a learning curve to do that. But yeah, we just kept working on this stuff that was becoming more and more like acoustic based, I guess, this mellower shit that we're doing now compared to what it was before. And it just felt better. And I felt like I could express more of what I was feeling at the time. There's also like this very significant thing that informs all this is that my sister took her own life. And,
I'm sorry.
No, thank you. Hey, man, I appreciate it. So this is 2018 that happened. Actually, this is really fucked up. My son's mother took her life in April. And then,
oh, man.
And then in September, my sister took her life. And so it was just like, fuck. Like, Bill broke his arm in December. And we first played our first like acoustic show of this kind of shit in February. And then Micah's mom, my son's mother, took her life in April, and we were like kind of rocked by that. And then my sister took her life in September, and dude, it was just like, fuck, man. You know what? That's what music's for, man. Because you can't make sense of this stuff. Like, you know, I deal with it now. It's like you deal with it however you can, or if you're smart, you get help to deal with it. But. It just it was just different after that, man. Shit is just different. I don't even know like what to say about it. And it's like felt music. Music's always done what it does for me. I know it does the same thing for you. It's a way of processing how beautiful and fucking tragically fucked up the world is. That's what it does, and that you reflect that back to other people, and they can take part in that with you and whatever. But that was just like, fuck. And you know it's kind of like we were talking about COVID. Like, I'm not gonna sit here and write a song about this global pandemic. I've heard people try it for the past year and a half, and it's just usually not a good idea. But if something is peripheral or somehow, you know, that's like, you know, or associate, like it can be something that happens to you that's associated with this thing, but you don't want to write about that. And that's kind of how these yeah. tragedies in 2018. I'm not going to sit here and, you know, I'm not going to write a.
I'm not going to write USA for COVID.
Yeah. And same thing with the personal tragedies. I'm not going to write about this thing specifically, but what I started to realize, if I would like step back from it enough and just let myself wonder for half a second, like, okay, where is that coming from? Because it feels, you know, just like when you write, it's subconscious. Like when you write songwriting, and this is much different for me, the songwriting that is on that last album and is on this record, it happens much easier, and it happens much more natural, and it happens much faster and much more subconscious. And I'm not talking about the recording and the overdubbing and doing that. I'm just talking about the idea of the songs. And,
maybe even the need to do it?
Yeah, the need's always been there. Because you remember when we were talking about back for that brief period in 2010 when I wasn't in a band. It's like, I think you asked me, did I miss being in a band or whatever. It's like, no, because I still have my guitar there, you know. And it's like, I wasn't really feeling like I just needed to express anything at that point. And but there is a need to play the guitar. There is a need to pick up the guitar because... if I can't turn everything else off for some period of the day, and you know, you can sit and meditate and do all that, and that's important too, but I'm just saying something that is for the sake of itself rather than some end means like getting a gig or making a record or, you know, getting likes or doing any of that bullshit. It's like just for me, just for the guitar, you know, just for this relationship that I have with the guitar is important. But, from that point on, that took on an even more important role for me, to have that time to sit there and tune everything else out and sort of just communicate. Not even communicate, just sit there and just be with the guitar. It's important to me, you know, and that, well, I found that you kind of zone out hard enough and come, you know, kind of come back to, like, almost from a dream state, and you're like, well, here's this little thing, kind of that little riff I was showing you, that little bluegrass thing. You're just sitting there. I don't, you know, I think earlier in when I was writing music, it's like I had an idea of what I wanted to make or what I thought it should sound like, and I don't have that now. I don't have any preconceived notions about what I should or shouldn't do, or what, whether it's a bluegrass lick or a rock lick or a blues lick or a nothing lick, whatever the fuck it is. It's like, just play with it and just sit there with it and let it be. It's like a much more, I'm not going to say mindful. fuck that. But you know what I mean? It's just letting it fucking happen, man. It's like,
it's openness.
It's just being open and not editing myself and not thinking about what I shouldn't do, because I would still hit that sometimes. I know that last record was called A Love That Leads to War. And that was the first step as far as like a recording that came out that highlighted this process or this type of direction. And that song itself, I did not want to put on in the group of songs I gave them to pick a record. We gave them 23 songs for that record, and there's 15 songs on it. And I did not want that to be one of them because I thought it was stupid. It's thinking about Jesus. It's a song about Jesus. You know, and I was like, that's just so trite. Like, to sing about, like, you know, it's like when you're in a bar, you don't talk about art or religion or politics. Isn't that the rule?
I guess, but...
But you know, so it's like, I don't want to hit anybody over the head or, like, fucking... And Laurel's like, dude, it's
there are ways to do it that but are she was, personal.
Well, right, and to me, it was very personal, but maybe it was too personal, or maybe I just thought it was silly, or... Dude, really, the way... I don't know. It might be like this with you. You can like something you did one day for one reason and then hate it the next day for a different reason and then like it another day for a completely different reason you've ever... Like,
yeah, I go songs through that can change meanings.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
totally.
So... but I was just someplace. I was like, this song is about Jesus being a liar or whatever the fuck it was. And it's like, and she was like, just give it to him. And then he included it. And that was the title. And actually, that was the only song on that record that my daughter was singing with me on. Laurel's not on that song. And there's one on this record, too. Because she lives at the house, she'll come in there and sing sometimes, which is cool. That's a fun part of the process, is having them around and they kind of get involved with it.
Yeah, I saw the New Yorker writer mention that. In the thing,
that's a great example of what I'm talking about, of something I guess where I kind of found what we're doing now is that day we got her driver's license and came home, you know, she had her permit and she drove to the driver's license place and then we did her thing and she drove around and got her license and then she drove home, but didn't have her own car yet, but wanted to take the car. I don't think she had her own car. Her brother gave her a car. Her brother's very generous. My son, he's a great dude. But she wanted to go. We live right in Overton Square, and she wanted to take the car to a volleyball game at Central High School. And I was just like, I mean, fuck, I know this is why we just went and got the license, is exactly for this reason. So you can do the, you know, you can go do what you need to do when you need to do it. So she left, and I was just sitting there like, it's a heavy feeling, man. You know, and you did, you know, we had that whole conversation, you know, a car is like a gun. If you use it the wrong way, you can kill someone. You know, it's just like, and so it's like, shit, she's out there, you know, doing this now. And I'm just sitting there not, you know, feeling very content in the fact that, like, this is another milestone. You know, we reached this milestone together and that's awesome. But just that parental, like, fear of... her being out in the car and just sat down. I mean, the song is like three chords. I have a bunch of those songs. It's like, that's the other thing that's fun about this, is because I used to be so, even in noise choir, like I had a thing, it's like, I'm not using power chords. What the fuck is that? Like, there's, I would limit myself from things because I felt like they were things that people leaned on.
Cliche. Yeah,
yeah, it was a cliche. And I was like, there's nothing wrong with power chords. They're awesome. It's fucking, that's how rock and roll gets made and so many other great things. But I was just trying to always find a way to, like, do something. It was like some kind of weird self-imposed, like, limitation to try to make myself figure out something else. And I'm like, dude, I just don't give a shit if it's like, you know, E, A, B, or C, D, and or C, G, and F, whatever the fuck, like, the most basic way for me to try to communicate this feeling. And so, yeah, some of that stuff is easy now if it you know, if the mood is right, or if I'm in such of a mindset that I'm in this place, then you can just make kind of do it. It's fun.
It took me forever to get to a place where I realized that it wasn't like the uniqueness of a chord progression that makes something interesting. It's coming through me that makes it interesting.
You're right. That's exactly what it is. It doesn't have to be complicated. It doesn't have to be fancy. It doesn't even have to be
well done.
Doesn't
have to have a weird time signature or some complicated stops or whatever.
No, it just has to feel, people just have to feel what it is that you're trying to express. And if you've done that, then you've done a pretty good job, you know? And so that's how I feel about it. And it is, yeah. It's not like that every time that you have an emotion, you can just sit down and write a song. But it's one of those things that the more you do it and the more familiar you become with your own process and the more you trust your own process, then it's like, that feels like a good spot to be in to me.
Well, let me ask one more thing. Given the injury and kind of the new direction of the band, I'm curious about what the live future of the band might be.
It's going to be what we were doing before COVID, because we toured a little bit on that first record. We had some friends that came up from Australia, Thighmaster and Michael Beach, and we helped them book some shows here in 2019. They had a record that came out in September of 2019 on Goner, and ours was coming out in October. And so they came over, and we went out to the West Coast and did like San Francisco and LA, and came through the Southwest with them. And it's me and Laurel with either Coltrane Duckworth and Keith. I think the new line is going to be Coltrane and Jesse Davis, because Coltrane and Jesse are both on this new record, playing lead guitar, playing electric guitar. I play that nylon string guitar. Laurel was playing a drum machine pad, and Keith plays the synth. So it's just electric guitar, synth, acoustic guitar, and drum machine. But I think we're going to put together like a little bit more full version for shows coming up. I don't know when we're going to be playing shows again, this fall maybe, definitely by next spring, but it'll just be the same thing. Like, I'll sit there in a chair and she stands up. I think we're actually going to get a percussionist, because there's stuff on there that's like a live snare with brushes and stuff that would sound better with a little bit more like filled out like percussion setup, drums setup. But
yeah.
And then Keith on sub bass, as far as I know right now, and Jesse and Coltrane kind of switching out to fill these out. But you can get by with like pretty simple arrangements. They're pretty basic.
Cool.
Yeah.
Are you guys going to be playing Gonerfest or anything like that?
I don't know right now. I don't know what we have planned for the rest of the year. We're just kind of taking it a day at a time. We don't have anything booked right now, and the only thing we've done some streaming stuff. Like, we've played,
I saw one of the Goner TV things in the store.
Yeah, we've done that a couple times, and we did the streaming Goner Fest thing last year, and we did they had this Memorial Day meltdown thing some people put on last year on Memorial Day, which is just over a year ago. So I think we did four streaming things during the course of all this shutdown, but all of those were with just she and I playing. Just me playing guitar and her. She plays a little harmonica sometimes for fun, just to, you know, spice it up. Bluesy. But yeah, we haven't done a streaming thing with the full band. And, you know, I've watched a lot of streaming stuff, and some of it's been really good and some of it's been really bad. And I think it just has to do with either like whatever your capability is with what you're using to do it with. And also, yeah, just how good it, you know, you make it sound. Because some of them I've seen are great. They sound great. And I've seen other ones that's kind of like you can tell people are feeling it out. You know, this is across the spectrum of music, just kind of tuning in to see what different bands or people are doing. But we haven't done a band streaming thing.
Yeah, I've been watching a lot of the streaming stuff from Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of how I chose what places I wanted to play. I was like, what clubs have the two best streaming setups?
Who sounds good when they're doing
B-Side and Black Lodge?
Hell yeah. Oh, that's perfect. Yeah.
So,
are they going to stream the show Friday?
B-Side is going to stream it live on Wednesday. And then Friday, they're going to tape it. And then we're going to stream it later.
Wait, are you playing Wednesday and Friday?
I am playing both.
Oh, wait, so y'all are playing tomorrow night?
Mm-hmm.
Wait, is this the same show?
No, I mean, my band, it will essentially be the same show.
So what is the show at B-Side tomorrow? I know
it's
this
just
is
me and it's just me and Ben Ricketts playing.
Oh, cool.
Streaming.
I haven't seen Ben play.
Come down.
Cool. And then Friday is the whole thing with Loose Opinions, you, and Jeremy. Okay, cool.
Yep.
Hell yeah. Dude, I haven't even seen live music through this whole thing. I went to a show 2 weeks ago. There were some bands playing on top of the Lamplighter And that was cool. They were, you know, I was outside in that little park across the street. And that's the only thing that I've seen. So, yeah, I haven't even, like, really been around, like, you know, live.
My first thing was rock music. Was this Saturday.
Yeah. It's crazy. After, I think the last show that we played was on February 12th or something of 2020. And even that show, we didn't play with the extended band because I think that they had something else going on that night. And so we were like, we'll just do this with the two of us. So everything we've been doing is with just the two of us. So, yeah, it'll be cool to get a band back together and play with, you know, with people again. It'll be fun.
Well, hey, do you want to try to play that song real quick?
Yeah, I'll show you that song.
Let's do it.
You already have the explanation, right?
Take it away. I mean, take it away.
But you have the explanation recorded of what it is, or should I?
I think I do, but if you want to do it again for posterity.
All right, yeah. All right, so we were talking about the whole thing about, like, you know, you don't want to write a song about COVID, like, oh, we were all locked down, but I could feel the love. Yeah, I don't want to do that. It's fucking stupid. But anyway, well, just whatever, to each his own. But anyway, but one thing that did happen during COVID is I had to meet my weed person. And my weed person was super paranoid about COVID and came to meet me in our chosen spot with his, like, the mask on. Obviously, we had gloves on and a thing of Lysol. And he made me hold out the $20 bills so he could spray them off with Lysol. And then he made me, like, flip it upside down so where my fingers had been touching, he could spray that with Lysol. And I was like, weird. So my fingers smelled like Lysol, and I had the weed, and he left. And I was like, what a weird fucking thing. I had to have this dude spray down the money with Lysol so it would be disinfected 99.9% of all germs and bacteria. But but I've been playing
shout
this
out Lysol.
Yeah, but I've been, and I think it was even an off brand from the dollar store. It was like, you know, it's something that says like cost, or like you cost save or whatever, like budget save Lysol. And then but I had this bluegrass lick because it's just a little peek into the process. But I was like, dude, I need to write about that without in some kind of way. But I had this bluegrass lick going. I think it's bluegrass. I'm sure some bluegrass people be like, that's not bluegrass. Why do I keep hitting the wrong thing? It's over.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
Quick editor's note, Aquarian Blood will in fact be appearing at Gonerfest this year in September. JB just didn't know it at the time of the interview. Now, to close the show, let's hear the full recorded version of the song JB played live. This is Spray Them All.
A little piece this reindeer more. He could slay them all. He could slay them all.
That's the show. Thank you, J.B. Harrell, Aquarian Blood, and Goner Records. Thank you, Arthur with two H's, for the opening theme. Thank you, Joey Pegram, for the closing theme. Thank you for listening, as always. For music, news, and episode archives, visit backtothelight.net. And until next week, take care, y'all. Part of the Back to the Light Podcast Network at backtothelight.net.